Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to take a look at the world of insects. Lots going on in insect land these days, and we have a couple of guests for you to talk about it. One, been with us many times, P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. P.J., good to have you back.
Good to be here, Larry.
And with us as well, Russell Groves, vegetable extension specialist and applied insect ecologist in the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. And Russ, good to have you with us for the first time.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. I appreciate being here, and it's good to be here with PJ.
Well, I tell you what, we'll have some fun talking with our two experts here. We'll talk about the insects found feeding on commercial crops and garden vegetables and flowers in Wisconsin. Some work and research on neonicotinoids. We'll talk about that. And, of course, we'll take your questions and comments. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us, email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. PJ, let's start with you. Last month, you helped the state ag department confirm the presence of elm zigzag sawflies in 20 Wisconsin counties. This is a new invasive for us. And is it of big concern?
Yeah, good question. And the short answer to that is, at this point, Larry, we don't know for sure. Being an invasive insect, we never quite know exactly how it's going to turn out. And I see a lot of non-native insects show up on the state, probably 2 to 3 in a given year. Yeah. Some of those, you're throwing grains of sand into a pond. You just get little ripples, very minimal impact. Sometimes they don't survive or persist. In other cases, you're throwing a huge boulder into the pond, big wave. So we don't know how big of a splash it's going to be. We also don't understand some aspects of the biology. In some situations, elm zigzag sawfly just causes a trivial amount of damage to the foliage of elm trees. And that's what it feeds on, specifically as elm trees. But in other cases, it can defoliate trees outright. And if you have an elm tree or tree in general that's in good health and it's good, gets defoliated once, it's probably going to be okay. But if that happens again and again, then I start to worry more about secondary issues popping up.
How do they get around? Here we are in 20 counties already.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch how quickly this insect has appeared on the scene and then popped up in a bunch of locations. A couple things are really going for it. First of all, with this insect, they're all females. They don't have to waste time looking for a mate. They can essentially clone themselves. So that speeds things up. They can also go through multiple generations per year. And we don't know at this point how many they'll do in a given year in Wisconsin. If it's warm enough, they could go through as many as 4 to potentially 6 or so. In our area, if I had to guess, it might be 2-ish, but that might vary from year to year. We just don't know at this point. But also the adults are capable of flying upwards of maybe close to 50 miles in a season. So for whatever reason, when I look at a map, these things have popped up in a big swath across the state. And again, it's been around 20 or so counties at this point where they've been confirmed. So to go from our first detection around 4th of July to about 20 counties, this thing's popping up left and right.
So I liked your fact sheet. You've got a great new fact sheet on this. I love the photos. And when I heard the name zigzag sawfly, I thought, well, there must be some sort of zigzag pattern on it. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It's the way that it eats.
Exactly. Yeah, when the larvae are small, and if you're not familiar with sawflies, by the way, sawfly larvae look very caterpillar-like, but they're actually related to ants and bees and wasps. But they have this caterpillar-like appearance, and when they're small, they feed in this meandering zigzag pattern on leaves, and that's very, very distinctive for this insect. Nothing else is going to cause damage like that on elm trees, so it makes it very easy from a detection standpoint to be able to pick out this insect.
So what should people do if they encounter these
Yeah,
cocoons or whatever.
Great question. And at this point, we don't fully know, again, the impacts of this insect. In some cases, it's going to cause a trivial amount of damage. In other cases, it could cause complete defoliation. So part of it is going to be waiting and watching. In terms of what to do, I would say if you bump into it, you know, let me or Mino or Department of Ag know, because we are generally trying to keep track of roughly where it is in the state. But also, if you see it doing significant damage, there are some things that you could do. It would depend on tree size, though. You know, if you have, a relatively young elm tree in your yard, maybe it's 10 feet tall, 12, 15 feet tall, there are some insecticide options you could use, including some pretty low-risk stuff like insecticidal soaps and horticultural oils. You'd have to spray it right on the larvae, but that works well against other sawflies, and that should work. If you have a larger tree and you're seeing a lot of damage, simply waiting and watching. If they're basically done causing a damage, that might be one approach. Again, the tree should leaf out. But in the future, you might need to chat with a certified arborist to discuss the situation, what potential treatment options there might be for those big trees.
Okay. Russ, let's turn to you. And you work as an entomologist focused on insects that feed on commercial and fresh market vegetables, crops. Which insects are the biggest threats to food grown here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, Larry. Well, as we all know, Wisconsin has a long and rich history of vegetable production in the state, from commercial all the way down to, you know, direct market and even organic production. So in our commercial industries where we grow potatoes and sweet corn, green beans, et cetera, you know, some of the rogues gallery of insects would include the Colorado potato beetle, necessarily.
Sure.
That feeds on potatoes. On that crop also, potato leafhopper is another insect that we see that causes actually a lot more damage than people truly ever realize. And that, again, spans from the commercial industry all the way down to the home gardener. In a crop like sweet corn, the ear-infesting pests like corn earworm, and then also one that's, relatively new is called Western Bean Cutworm. That insect has been with us now, you know, at pest levels for at least 15, 20 years. That's an insect that we're seeing a fair amount of.
This time of the year, what are we seeing out there? I mean, of those that you've discussed.
Yeah. Well, for sure in sweet corn, it is the time of year when we're seeing an abundance of corn earworm. And to be quite honest, we just came off of what was a generation of Western bean cutworm. So most growers, most producers would have known through moth captures that come from the Department of Ag, that come from the Wisconsin Home Pest Survey. They can always check, and there are pheromone captures, pheromone traps that they run, which is a very important and timely resource for people to look at. They can see, and we did. We just came off of that generation. There's the potential we may see a little bit more damage from that insect, but I think the major threat for that insect has ebbed now.
Yeah. So for, you work with the commercial folks. Home gardeners, is it much of a problem with insects?
Well, it sure can be. I think it just matters, you know, what the individual's, you know, perception of the problem is.
Yeah.
You know, many of us are familiar with the fact that worms can be in our sweet corn. So some of us might, you know, pull that shuck back and they see the worm. Some people are, you know, really put off by that. So as a home gardener, maybe they want to control that. Others, they might pull that shuck back, see that worm, break the tip of that off, and they know that the rest of that sweet corn is just fine to eat. So it's all kind of in a personal preference. But yeah, I mean, in years where they're numerous, and this year, in fact, they are, they can be, you know, pretty damaging for middle to late season, you know, production of sweet corn.
I love sweet corn. So, and it feels like, okay, that once the Sun Prairie Sweet Corn Festival is on, I know, okay, well, it's going to be a downslide from there. The rest of the season is just, that was just, what, last weekend or something, I think it was. So there you go. PJ, how big a, let's get back to Japanese beetles for a minute. because they always seem to be on people's minds. How big a problem are they this year?
It really depends on where you're located. In probably the southern half or so of Wisconsin, this isn't uniform across the board. There's still some hot spots here and there. But overall, for the southern half of Wisconsin, they haven't been too bad. And that's really a pattern I've been seeing now for the last couple of years. I suspect there's some weather at play. This year, we've been a little bit rainier, especially early in the spring and early summer, drier more recently in many areas, but dry the last couple of years. And so I suspect that has impacted them. Once you get up to about the Highway 29 corridor, so Green Bay to Wausau to Eau Claire, from that part of the state on north, that's actually where I have been getting more of my reports of the beetles themselves, of damage as a whole. Whereas 5-10 years ago, it was very much southern Wisconsin and reports in the north were rare. So that's kind of the lowdown on what I've been seeing recently. One other interesting thing, though, to note, there's an insect called the winsome fly, which is a parasite of Japanese beetles. And this is something that over the last decade, I've seen very few reports of. And then this year, I have seen some reports of decent rates of parasitism. And this is an insect. It's actually very easy to pick out when it parasitizes adult Japanese beetles because it lays a couple of whitish eggs just behind the head, kind of the neck region, if you will. We call it the pronotum. But it's very conspicuous. You can see that with the naked eye. And so I've had some reports from kind of west central Wisconsin. Russ and I have a colleague at University of Minnesota that's surveying for these. And then I also, about a month ago, I was up in Minocqua area and outside the library there near some public gardens, saw quite a few adults that had these eggs of that insect on there. So again, I wonder if over time this enemy insect, natural enemy, is starting to kick in, build its numbers, and that might help us out in the long run. That's been really interesting to see this summer.
Lupe and Iola wonders if she can introduce weevils to a parcel to eat the spotted knotweed as part of a prairie restoration project, and wonders if there's unintended consequences that could come from introducing weevils.
Yeah, really good question. I know there are a number of invasive weeds in the state that maybe come from overseas, Europe in a lot of cases. And so what scientists can do is go to the native range of that plant, try and find a specialist herbivore. This is something that is only going to attack, ideally, that plant and only that plant. And then they can't just import it and let it loose and let it run wild. They usually have to do a number of screening experiments just to make sure it is truly specific and it's not going to attack some native close relatives here. So there are efforts like that. Usually, though, those sorts of insects are not commercially available or readily available. So it's not something you can just call up someone and ask for a bunch of those beetles. Rather, the way that those introductions work, it's usually introduced by a government entity in a lot of cases.
Okay.
It could be a research project with a university researcher, DNR, or something like that. Under very controlled situations, they'll release it, see if it establishes and has an impact. But it's usually not the sort of thing that you can just call up and order online.
Okay, that makes sense. P.J. Leash and Russ Groves, our guests today from the Department of Entomology at the UW-Madison. Russ is a vegetable extension specialist, an applied insect ecologist in the Department of Entomology. P.J., of course, is director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Talking the world of insects today here in our state with our two guests, entomologists from UW-Madison, P.J. Leash and Russ Groves. Great to have both of them with us. Questions for them, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We have... Russ, I want to get back to you for a minute because insecticides are on people's minds a lot. How do you work with the ag industry to develop management strategies for them?
Sure. Well, what we initially try to do is is ask people to consider what we call integrated pest management, which is considering all kinds of tools that may be at your disposal already that you can implement to achieve the kind of, you know, insect population or insect population goal that's not going to cause you problems. And so that can include such things as PJ was just referring to, a natural enemy. It can include such things as changing your planting dates. It can, you know, really, really include a variety of different approaches and tactics that are really non-chemical. And to be quite honest, as much as anything, if we can have success in those ways, that's probably one of the best, you know, outcomes as far as sustainable ag. Unfortunately, and sometimes we do use insecticides. We may have to. If populations are being a little episodic, they're getting large, you know, et cetera. And so we do. We work closely with people to put together sequences or programs of control where they're very mindful of human health, worker protection, worker safety, and then also what might be the, you know, the off-cropped impacts. So, and I will say this, that over the last, 15, 20 years, we've really been fortunate that the U.S. EPA has been implementing a lot of evaluative programs that are pushing us in the direction of what we call reduced risk insecticides. So many of our registrants are, the compounds that are coming forward are very reduced risk, and they do have lower impacts in many cases on workers, you know, on agriculturalists, as well as the off-crop areas. So, again, it's in some cases it's a part of a, you know, a necessary evil, if you will, as far as part of agriculture, but they can be very important components of an IPM program.
Peter from Eden emailed us a photo of a wasp, said this insect landed on his glasses. He later learned it was a scorpion wasp, which concerned Peter given that it was about a half inch away from his eyeball. And he wondered, would like to know more about this insect and whether it stings humans, PJ.
Yeah, so what's in the photo is a pretty sizable wasp, and in real life, these things are about an inch and a half or so long, blackish. The abdomen on it is very, very skinny and elongated, and it does kind of curl under, would remind you a little bit of a scorpion. This is a female pelicinid wasp, and although they may be look a little intimidating with that stinger-like structure, they're actually quite harmless. What that structure does, the female uses it to probe down into the soil. She locates May June beetle grubs, and she's going to parasitize those. So that it's a special egg-laying device. I have actually seen these a couple times myself, where I've been able to capture it with my bare hand and hold it.
Yeah.
And just as a behavior, they will attempt to probe and sting you, but they're not actually capable of stinging. It's enough that it would kind of be like poking yourself with the tip of a ballpoint pen. You'll feel some pressure, but it's not going to break the skin or anything.
Ron in Ronald in Ephraim has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ronald.
Hello. So up in Ephraim and in northern Door County, we have a lot of the emerald ash borer beetle, which has devastated the ash tree population. We're involved in the removal of some of those trees, and I'm wondering what foreign species might be threatening other tree species in our county and in our state, and what might be next for trees that are threatened by invasive species.
Yeah, great question. I mentioned this earlier in the show, but I typically see about 2 to 3 non-native insects show up in the state every single year. And as I mentioned, sometimes these have minimal impact, or they show up and then they just can't survive. But in other cases, they become established and can cause some serious problems for us. So specifically, when I think of places like Door County, one that has already shown up in the last 10 to 15 years that I know is causing some issues in like home lawns is the European chafer. But there's always some other things that I've got on my radar. earlier this year, I would have had Elm Zigzag Sawfly on my radar to watch for. And now we've just in the last month or so confirmed it in the state. So if you have elm trees around, that would be something to watch for as well. But some other things that I've got on my radar at the moment, there's a spotted lanternfly. I know we've talked about on the show in the past. That it wouldn't surprise me if it showed up in the next 5 to 10 years. If you have boxwood shrubs in your landscaping, there's something called the box tree moth, which has a presence in other parts of the country, but it's something that I've got on my radar because it can cause some very serious damage to boxwood trees. And it's really interesting because when you think about worldwide, over 1 million described insect species, and if you take something from another part of the globe, Europe, East Asia, something like that, there's a chance it's going to cause problems here. And so what I often watch for to have pests on my radar, are there insects that maybe originate in, say, East Asia that made it to Europe? And because of the history of U.S. landscaping, we have a lot of plants brought from Europe to here historically. And so if I see an insect that has gone from parts of Asia or somewhere else to Europe and caused problems there, that makes me suspicious. If it gets here, it could be a problem here. And that's what we've seen with that box tree moth. Got to Europe, caused a lot of damage there on their boxwoods. Elm Zigzag Sawfly, before it got here, showed up in Europe about 20 years ago, now widespread and has caused damage to elm trees there. And so that's why we know it could be a concern here as well.
Ron, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City next. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. A friend of mine has large containers of rye and buckwheat berries that he grinds into flour. He has small flies in there, and he's wondering if you can speculate what kind of flies, what he should do about it. And the other question is, with all the talk about consuming insects, should he just cook them up and get his protein?
Well, maybe Russ or and or PJ could chime in on that.
Sure. I mean, in this case, I'd say it'd be really helpful to see some photos or a sample of the insect, because there's a lot of things that can get into grains and things like that. And I would want to know, are these just insects hanging out on maybe the soil surface, or are they getting into and infesting the grain itself, which I probably wouldn't expect, but that could really make a difference in terms of if you want to do anything. If it's something just hanging out in the pot, say fungus gnats, I would say don't worry about it at all. But if it's something infesting and attacking the grain itself, then we might want to consider doing something about it.
Yeah, and Russ, what would attack rye or buckwheat?
Well, as PJ said, I mean, it. The caller mentioned a fly, but it would really be good to, I think, get, you know, a picture so that we can better know that. It seems to me there are a wide range. I mean, we see things like, you know, meal moth and others that, you know, superficially you might assume is a fly when in fact it's a, you know, it's a small, you know, moth.
Yeah.
So in my estimation, it would be good to get, you know, get the image to see. But there are many different species, you know, red flower beetle. There's just many different things that could be infesting. So
PJ Leisha and Russ Groves, our guests today, we're taking a look at the world of insects. And I want to give a big shout out, by the way, to all of professionals and the folks at the Beaver Creek Reserve, just right outside of Eau Claire. Excuse me. We were there yesterday, and after I did a radio show from there, and afterwards had a chance, thanks to them, to the folks at Beaver Creek, they tagged monarch butterflies, and they let me tag one of their monarchs and that male monarch was off to who knows where, maybe South America. They've had these tagged monarchs appear in South America right from the Beaver Creek Reserve. And I've got to say, too, that Liz, one of our people, members of our group, shot some video of me tagging the monarch butterfly, and it's already up on Instagram and our Facebook page. And if you want to see that video, just go to our Facebook page or go to Instagram. But we have a link today at our Larry Mueller Show page. So you can go to today's date on talk@WPR.org or WPR.org/Larry. Just go there and you can get a link and you can see me actually tagging a monarch butterfly. I bring that up just because I want people to see that, but also there's a new study out that shows a link between the decline of monarch butterflies and the use of ag insecticides in the Midwest. Does this surprise you, PJ or Russ?
Not terribly surprising once I read the details of the study. It was really interesting to read this particular paper when you think about insect declines. We know that there are a lot of interacting factors, and that makes it very hard to tease out which ones are pulling on the strings harder than others and playing more important roles. So we know there's things like land use changes, although when you think about historically, yeah, we have changes to the landscape around us, but a lot of the land use changes have really occurred in the last 200 or so years. Deforestation and stuff like that. So we don't have as many drastic land use changes to that extent. There are other things like climate change, and we know that from year to year, weather patterns play a really big role in terms of fluctuations in insect populations, and we, of course, can't control that. But then the researchers for the study also looked at huge data sets, and it's been interesting because of some of the insecticides used over the last 20 to 30 years, specifically the neonicotinoid group, which in theory sound really interesting in terms of how they can be used by growers. They can be used as seed treatments, meaning that the grower doesn't necessarily have to go back out to that field and spray every week to control insect pests, which has happened sometimes historically. Rather, they can have treated seed planted at the beginning of the season. That plant is protected during the growing season, but we know that sometimes those products end up in the soil and the water, and they can move elsewhere and get in other plants. And so what the study found is that the neonicotinoid insecticides seem to be a key factor for monarchs, which, again, isn't too surprising when we see these neonicotinoids first came out in later parts of the 1990s, adopted very widely, very rapidly, especially in the Midwest. And so to see that there is an impact like that wasn't terribly surprising to me, but also alarming at the same time that this is going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Russ, a comment?
Yeah, we do. We see, unfortunately, a significant amount of what we call, you know, off-site movement of these neonics. They're showing up in a variety of different, you know, locations and places in both our surface and groundwaters. And so those and their association, you know, with these declines is compelling and interesting. It is, I won't say surprising, but it's interesting to me. The moths and butterflies don't really respond to the neonics in terms of the kind of control that if you were choosing to, let's say, control a corn earworm, as the example we used earlier, which is, of course, the larval stage of a moth, you wouldn't choose a neonicotinoid insecticide because they do not have efficacy on that group. But that's not to say that their, you know, their widespread distribution, the, you know, their prevalence in the environment and the impacts that they're having on, you know, a variety of other taxa, a variety of other insects, you know, is potentially associated with these kinds of declines for sure.
Yeah. And they're banned. Neonics are banned, I think, in Europe. Are they not?
Russ, you'd probably know more specifics on that. I know they have a lot more rules and restrictions on use of products like that compared to here.
Yeah. Certain countries do have bans, and then other countries do have some modifications in terms of the different kinds of crops on which they're used. Here in the U.S., they are used quite widely and are registered on a variety of different crops. In fact, I think a recent estimate I heard was worldwide, the neonic insecticides accounted for 25% of all of the registered pesticide use globally. And when you think about, and that includes herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides, So that indicates that they are used, you know, quite frequently, quite abundantly.
We, and I guess the alternatives, are there alternatives out there for them?
Oh, absolutely. There are some, as we talked about a moment ago, there are materials that are coming along that are available and accessible now. One of those that is, as an example, is a very soft compound that we use now against Colorado potato beetle. And Larry, I talked with you, this was probably going on about 3 years ago, a newly registered compound that knocks out the genes in the Colorado potato beetle. And so when it's sprayed, it knocks out a gene just specifically in that insect. So it's a very target-specific kind of control. And, you know, that is just one example, among others, of newer active ingredients that we see coming along that are, it's just an example of alternatives to things like the neonics.
We received an email from a wholesale vegetable producer south of Madison who said they have seen an unusual number of flea beetles this year. They're so small. And wondering, is this because the soil was too wet for reproduction? Would this be true for the second generation of maybe the cabbage maggot?
Yeah. I have to concur that we have seen an abundance of flea beetles. There's, maybe three or four different species of flea beetle that we might see in the garden or in the field. And it depends on the crop on which they're attacking. But I think the main explanation is the fact that the winter of 2023-24 was unfortunately not much of a winter at all.
Yeah.
And things like flea beetles, and I've heard PJ talk about this in previous shows this spring, European earwig, as another example, is quite abundant. And we kind of chalk that up to just a lot of overwintering survivorship. So, you know, in a historic or good Wisconsin winter where we have a lot of frost that sets in the ground and maybe in the ground for, let's say, 6 to 8 weeks. That's a long-term killing factor. And last year, unfortunately, the 1 week, maybe 7 to 10 days when we had a little bit of cold, we actually had 8 or 10 inches of snow on the ground at that very time. And so the ground really never froze. We didn't have much frost that went all the way up to like Wausau. So many insects survived. So I think one great example of that is the survivorship that we saw of flea beetle. That's a good example, though, I think, or a good opportunity here to mention. Flea beetles will. They'll just overwinter right in the same place, you know, where they were abundant in the previous year. So if you had crucifer flea beetle that, for example, was on your kale or was on, you know, a mustard, for example, or mustard greens, and you don't, you know, take much care to be able to move those plants, you know, some distance, and you put them right back in the same place in the garden, well, you've set the table, and those insects will pop right back. And again, with a lot of survivorship from last winter, they popped right back up, and they were there in abundance. Cabbage, you know, cabbage maggot, unfortunately, it's kind of a similar phenomenon. Those insects, they're going to overwinter as pupa. That's, of course, the stage between the maggot or the larva and then the adult. They're going to be overwintering as pupa, and they might be a little bit more resistant to the cold chilling. But again, we just didn't have much of a winter.
Right.
So they were abundant, a lot of insects.
Everywhere.
A lot of insects had a lot of success last year.
Carol emailed to say this spring there was a huge pill bug population in their community garden. The soil was covered by a leaf mulch over winter. The pill bugs made it hard to get brassicas started because they consumed many leaves. Mm-hmm. Does leaf mulch create a larger pill bug population? What organic techniques can be used to reduce their impact?
Yeah, well, it's a very good observation as well. And pill bugs, they are a detritivore, meaning they're feeding on decaying organic matter generally. And so And then, of course, another feature of this year has been our very regular and in some case excessive pattern moisture.
Yeah.
So when someone, you know, puts a, you know, an organic mulch on the garden, maybe even over the winter or in the spring, and to be honest, if they don't incorporate that and they leave it, this year what we've done is we've created an environment that's, you know, really optimal for those kinds of insects to persist and be present in there. And again, I'm not trying to, you know, devalue, you know, a mulch and what the mulch brings. But when you have the moisture that we've had, it just creates that environment. And the person's observation is spot on. Small plants that are trying to break through that, those pill bugs,
they're,
you know,
right,
roly polies, yeah. They'll take a few bites, and when there's numbers like there have been, you know, a few bites is very obvious to us. So if we can get plants in the ground and get them up, get them through, and once they're established and well established for a week or 10 days, they usually leave them alone. But it's that early development when they kind of get dinged.
Lots of emails here. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Jane in Oregon emailed to say they have had tomato hornworms for the last 2 years. She hand culled them, but what can she do to prevent the hornworms from returning again next year?
Yeah. I'd say there's not really anything in particular you can do to deter them outright. But if you are growing tomatoes and related plants like peppers, where we know hornworms can show up, my best piece of advice is keep a close eye on them, because if you can catch them early, maybe you're noticing part of a stem gone here or there.
Sure.
Go out, do that hand picking. That often works very well, especially for small garden areas. But the adults can fly long distances, so you won't be able to deter them outright.
I just was comment yesterday, a colleague and I, Dr. Amanda Gevins, who's a plant pathologist, we were in a garden walk up near Mequon, and we were visiting and touring and talk about insect pests. And I have to admit, because I think that's great advice, PJ, but I have to admit, even when they're late instars, they're old caterpillars, those hornworms can blend in to, you know, to the tomato plants, and they're just really hard to see. So you have to get in there and you really have to pay attention. So, you know, to be able to find them.
Joseph in Fifield called, couldn't stay with us. He has for years bumblebees living in the walls of a shed, and wondering, we'd just like to learn more about the life cycle of bumblebees. I'm surprised it'd be in the same spot every year, PJ.
Yeah, a little surprising. I do see bumblebees nesting in occasionally foundations. You know, if someone's got an old farmhouse with a stone foundation, bumblebees in general are cavity nesters. They're looking for some sort of pre-existing cavity. So in a lot of cases, that's going to be in the ground, a pre-existing chipmunk burrow or something like that. But again, if there is some sort of void or hollow spot available, that could be maybe part of a wall void in a shed or underneath a shed if it's raised up on a platform or something like that, and there's a good spot there, they might keep coming back year to year potentially. They usually aren't going to be reusing the same exact nest, but they might have nests in the same location. But in terms of their life cycle, very briefly, they have annual life cycles. So they all die out in the fall, except for the new batch of queens that have mated, have been fertilized. Those hunker down in sheltered spots. They overwinter. All the other members of the colony die out. Then in spring, those overwintered queens essentially wake up. They become active when it gets warm enough. And it's a mad dash for them to try and establish nesting sites. And a lot of them are going to fail. But if she can find a good spot and establish a nest, at first, that new queen has to do all the work of raising young, foraging for pollen and nectar. Once she raises a workforce, then those workers go out and do the work. And so the colony builds up in size from one, the queen, reaching peak size late summer, early fall.
Peak size would be?
Depends on the species. Could be, for some bumblebee species, might be a matter of dozens. present of workers. In some cases, it might be hundreds potentially.
PJ Leash and Russ Groves, our guests today from the UW-Madison Department of Entomology. Great to have them with us. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of insects today here in Wisconsin with a couple of guests for you, PJ Leash and Russ Groves. And we're from the UW Department of Entomology, and we're looking at insects that may be in your home garden, or we may be looking at insects that are in, maybe you've got a commercial garden going, or commercial crops as well. We have answers for your questions. Great to have you listening in today. Mike in Madison emailed to ask if there's any truth to the rumor that multicolored lady beetles were released to combat alfalfa aphids, and then they escaped and became a pest.
Yep.
Russ?
That's about half true, I think. They were. They were brought in, and as PJ mentioned, they were brought into quarantine and evaluated, but they were going after pecan aphid. And so it was a pecan aphid that was in the Mid-South. So they were evaluated. They were deemed to be acceptable for release. And they were, and in fact, they do their job. I mean, they have had the effect of limiting pecan aphid populations, but somehow they didn't get the memo about where they were supposed to stay, because then they continued to spread basically, you know, all over much of North America. Yeah. And so, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also a really interesting backstory to it, though, because over the last 100 or so years, there were actually a couple of introductions, and they introduced them, and they just kind of flopped. They didn't seem to persist. And then all of a sudden, a couple decades back, they start popping up. And so we still don't know for sure, are they here and established because of a deliberate introduction, or was it some other accidental introduction? But as Rush mentioned, once they got here, got established, they didn't know where to stay, and so they really spread around.
Interesting. Mitch, who's northbound on Highway 39, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. So I have an infestation of fruit flies in a bar I own, and we are doing everything we can possibly do to try to eradicate these little buggers, and from bleach to covering all the bottles, wrapping fruit, and it just seems impossible. It's getting to the point where, you know, our customers are upset, and I don't know if they're hitchhikers. Some people complain that they're actually finding them in their homes. So I'm curious to find out if there's an eradication process or something we can do other than what we're already doing.
Yeah. PJ? Yeah.
I'd be curious to know in a case like this, if you're working with a pest management professional on the situation.
Yes.
You are.
We have somebody that comes monthly and sprays for, you know, everything.
Okay. And have they done a lot of essentially detective work looking for potential breeding sites for the larvae?
You know, they picked up the where the taps are. They picked up the mat underneath the taps, and they said that's a very common place. But short of ripping up the wood and looking underneath, which I wasn't real excited about, but at this point, I'm willing to pretty much do anything.
Okay. Yeah, well, the reason I asked about that with fruit flies and many other small flies, the key thing is you have to find out where the source of the population is. And even though we call them fruit flies, another name for them would really be vinegar flies. They love the scents associated with fermentation. And when you have a bar, you're serving beer and wine and stuff like that, they love the smell of that. And so what they essentially need to grow and develop, the females are looking for a spot that is moist. You have to have some moisture there. If things are dry, they can't survive or reproduce. They need moisture. They need some nutrition. That could be even just a little bit of carbohydrate. So in theory, you know, a forgotten about beer bottle or can or wine glass that got tucked here or there, that could be a source for them. And in a bar type setting, you know, there could be a lot of possibilities. It could be a little bit of spilt liquid behind something or down amongst the kind of the foot pads of bar stools or something like that. But often with these situations, you have to do some very thorough detective work. That can also mean maybe pulling out equipment, looking under sinks and stuff like that, because again, you need some sort of moisture that is going to persist there. Lower risk in my mind is the fresh fruit, and in a bar, you know, you got slices of lemons and oranges and stuff like that. I'm not really worried about that. It's got to be something that's sitting there for longer periods of time, some source of moisture. So doing detective work in a case like this and figuring out where the larvae are, these should be little whitish maggots. If you're finding those, that means you found a key location. Sometimes that could be associated with drains or plumbing issues. With bar settings, you have all the hoses from soft drink things and beer kegs and stuff like that, taking a close look at those. But it's often a matter of finding those sources, dealing with those, mitigating them, and cleaning them up rather than just going in and spraying. If all you do is spray and you don't get to the root of the problem, it's probably going to persist.
Yeah, there you go, Mitch. Got a little detective work ahead of you. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Ron emailed to ask, what is known about woody adelgids, insects that pose a threat to hemlock trees?
Yeah, so this is a type of sucking insect. They are related to aphids, and we have one called the hemlock woolly adelgid, which is a very serious pest of hemlock trees. There's a long history of it in the U.S., especially in parts of Appalachia. If you go to like the Great Smoky Mountains and that part of the U.S., there's a heavy presence there. More recently, there's a presence in the state of Michigan, just across the lake from us. We don't have it here in Wisconsin yet. That's something we do have on our radar. And each of these individual insects is small. And if you think of a hemlock tree, these can be 100 plus feet tall. So an individual insect doesn't cause that much damage, but they gang up in numbers. You can get hundreds of thousands of these on an individual tree, and they'll actually make the foliage look whitish because they're covered in this whitish material. And so it's kind of death by a thousand paper cuts, if you will, when you have huge populations of these. Some good news, at least at the moment for us in Wisconsin, I have seen some studies that looked at climate modeling, and based on some of the climate variables like winter temperatures and stuff like that, at this point we might be a little too cold for them in the parts of the state where we see hemlocks natively growing, the northern parts of the state. But that might change over time with climate change. So it's still something I think we need to be aware of and be concerned about. But at least at this point, it's not here in Wisconsin.
Hmm. Margaret emailed to ask if they are trying to control for Japanese beetles by treating their lawn in the spring and fall. Margaret says none of their neighbors are doing the same thing, so they wonder if they're wasting their money on the treatments.
Yeah, I generally don't recommend the lawn treatments unless your concern is for the lawn itself. I really view lawn treatments for Japanese beetle grubs and above ground adult damage is two different scenarios. And treating for the grubs, you're still going to have plenty of adults on your birch trees and rose bushes and things like that. So again, in terms of the overall management, I really wouldn't recommend treating for those grubs unless you're seeing a lot of turf damage or you have a very particular mindset of how you want your lawn to look. And if you have concerns for grubs, then you make that decision. But if you're treating for grubs, you won't have adults, it doesn't quite work like that.
Yeah. I don't care what my lawn looks like too much. I've got a little of everything in my lawn. I at one point I had that in thought in my head, I wanted a perfect lawn. I do no longer a desire to have one. So there you go. Well, having some fun today and an interesting time, as a matter of fact, talking with P.J. Leash, degrees in biological sciences and entomology, and is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Professor Russ Groves, is a vegetable extension specialist, applied insect ecologist in the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. He chairs the department, by the way, and supervises students and staff at the Vegetable Crop Entomology laboratory. I'll maybe ask him about that, too, as we move along today. We'll take a quick break to take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here, and then we'll be back with PJ and Russ. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at the world of insects today with our two guests from the UW-Madison Department of Entomology, P.J. Leash and Russ Groves. Russ actually is chair of the department, supervises students and staff at the Vegetable Crop Entomology Laboratory. So, questions for them, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Dick in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, my question is, I've had somebody inquire about placing beehives on my farm. My concern is I have some neighbors who are likely to use pesticides. I'm wondering how big a radius around a hive needs to be pesticide-free before those bees start to, you know, get some toxicity.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, great question. There's a lot of factors there because honeybees, they can travel very long distances. They can easily go over a mile, and it's just hard to find a spot on the map where you're not going to have agricultural land within a mile or two of you. So that's really hard to control. There are some things that can influence that as well. The type of pesticides, for example, we do have a system in the state where beekeepers can be notified of pesticide applications, and that allows them to essentially close up the hives, keep the bees in there for a little while until the application has been made and dried, and then they can let them go out and forage at a later point in time. So there are some precautions like that that can be used as well, but I don't have a firm answer on exactly, how great of a distance that should be. And again, it would also depend on the types of pesticides used, the active ingredients. Is it herbicide, fungicide, insecticide, and so on?
There was a 2022 study that suggested that the neonicotinoids can cause honeybees to forage less. I'm sure you guys are aware of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been a lot of attention on the neonicotinoids for at least a decade or so, with some relationships with bees, and they've been looked at for colony collapse and stuff like that. We know that the neonicotinoids, many of the ingredients from that class, can be very acutely toxic to bees if they're exposed to it. They have to be exposed to impact them. And so in some cases, if a bee went to a plant that had just been sprayed with a neonicotinoid, it's not too surprising that they could be killed from that. What's much harder to figure out, though, are some of these kind of indirect impacts, these sublethal impacts. And it might not kill the bees, but what if it impacts their ability to navigate? And for honeybees, it's really important to be able to, fly out a half mile or a mile, gather resources, and navigate back to the hive. And if you can't do that correctly, that's going to have a negative impact on the colony as a whole. So it's taking scientists a long time to tease out some of these very subtle impacts like that.
Yeah, and we call a lot of those these sublethal effects.
Yeah.
And, changes in fitness, insects and the development of, the young larval bees have been observed to be slower. Actually, one of the faculty in our department, James Crawl, is looking at the effects of these, neonics at sublethal doses and, indicating that, bees are unable to even thermoregulate. Insects, like, so many organisms, are always dealing with changes in both, cold and hot temperatures.
Sure.
So that's another example of the way that they're doing that. And to the caller and to Dick's specific question, I think PJ's right. At least a mile, and to some extent, I might even think of 2 miles as a distance, to limit that kind of exposure. And then I think the last thing I would add is, there's an entity called Driftwatch that you can look at online. And Driftwatch, I think, was originally intended, to for people to report against for herbicide drift if they sprayed a crop and that could move or move off-site. And they do have a resource at DriftWatch, which is a way for beekeepers to identify their site. And then what that does is that within a certain distance or a close distance, if someone is applying, you know, a pesticide, it gives them the opportunity to be able to call that individual, you know, if they locate a hive or a set of hives at a specific location. So check that out.
DriftWatch. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, and Eau Claire County, in Boyd and Eau Claire County. Your turn.
Okay, so I used to live in Milwaukee until 1975. So in the 50s, we had cockroaches down there. You couldn't kill these things if you wanted to. They got into your cupboards. See, people would have metal bread boxes where you put your bread in. But my brother finally bought a professional spray kit. And my stepdad, my mom, my other brother, we all went out for a Sunday or whatever. And he sprayed the whole apartment down. He finally got rid of them. But if the neighbors don't get rid of them, you can't get rid of them. But see, they were traveling. They used to collect soda pop bottles. They used to reuse them in beer bottles. So we bring them into the store, and they travel with the beer bottles and the soda pop bottles. And they still got the problem. So, you know, Gecko was their natural enemy. But they're so resistant to poison. You know, how do you actually get rid
of them? Okay. Well, cockroaches are, I would say, a hardy bunch.
They are, and really in terms of getting rid of them, Russ mentioned this term earlier, integrated pest management, and in a nutshell, you know, that means you are not just relying on spraying and using pesticides. There's a lot of things you can do. So if you had, say, a single-family house with cockroaches, one of the first things is to identify what sort of roach species you're dealing with, because that can influence management decisions. If someone contacts me and they have wood roaches, those are our native roaches that live out in the woods, then I'm talking to them about, well, don't bring in firewood, seal up cracks on the outside of your house. If you have something like German roaches, which are our commonest indoor roach species, that one is notorious worldwide for infesting homes and structures. Number of things can be done. First of all, those have pretty high moisture needs. They need free moisture. That can be water from a sink or condensation, but limiting and eliminating moisture, that's one helpful approach. Eliminating harborage areas. They like to hide behind things. And so if you have a bunch of clutter and a bunch of cardboard boxes around, cleaning that up, getting rid of hiding places can also help. They like to hide in places like wall voids. And so if you have pipes coming through walls, can you seal that up with steel wool or expanding insulation foam? That is going to limit access to hiding spots. That can be very helpful. These days, there are issues with insecticide resistance, and so it's very helpful if you have cockroaches to not keep using the same product again and again. If you do that, that can lead to problems. We like to rotate between ideally 3 to 4 different chemical classes. And then I will also say, historically, some of the roach baits really struggled. But newer roach baits in the last 20 or so years can actually work very, very well against roaches. And so that's a common approach. Also with roaches in general, because they can be, you know, more challenging than the ants that sneak in to go after sweets in your kitchen, sure, that sort of thing. And so with roaches, I do often suggest that if folks are struggling with it, to work with a pest management professional, because the professional exterminators are going to have a range of different sprays and baits and other types of products available, and they can come in and do follow-ups and see, are we seeing the populations trending downwards over time through using glue board traps and things like that. So there's really a bunch of different approaches you can take.
Thanks again, Vern, for that comment and question. Bill in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Biggest struggle for the last 6 years, the Drosophila spotted wing fruit fly destroyed my raspberries. I haven't gotten any, haven't been able to harvest anything in 6 years. They're now getting into my strawberries. I'm at a point to where I'm just going to dig everything out and forget growing any kind of fruit at all. What can I spray when the fruit, the apple cider vinegar traps I do, I know it's late already. They've probably already laid their eggs. What's the possibility of trying to control them?
Yeah, they're a challenge for sure. One thing is just physical avoidance. If you have a variety that's an early bearing variety, then they can generally escape, you know, the damage or the egg laying, actually an infestation of this fly. About the time we get into, oh goodness, probably the middle of July and beyond, you know, we have enough of these insects that are around and abundant. And if you have a bearing plant, there's a lot of opportunity for, you know, infestation. The noteworthy thing about this species, different from some of our other Drosophilids, or as PJ mentioned, vinegar flies, is this female fly has an ovipositor that is serrated like a saw. Mm. And so she can actually lay eggs in what we would call, you know, ripening, or to some extent close to unripe fruit. So they can place it there before, you know, we would often or typically associate, you know, an infestation to get established. If you have a susceptible crop that, you know, at this time, there are definitely some choices that producers have. And it is a situation or a circumstance where that might often require a form of reapplication, especially as, you know, you have a kingberry that often gets set maybe on a cluster. And then once you pick that kingberry, then you have a sequence of berries that come into ripening. That can be for raspberries, that can be for blueberries, that can be for strawberries. And in my estimation, probably the most widely used material is a material that contains the active ingredient spinosad, which is nice because it's a very reduced risk material. It has low mammalian toxicity. We do have to be careful with it as far as the application timing, especially if they're, you know, if the crop is still flowering. And a lot of those applications are actually made at night to avoid bees, because bees could be foraging on crops like that. But then what is often done is someone is applying that material maybe about a week before you are even getting your first ripe berry. And that's at a time when we anticipate the activity of those flies that are ovipositing. And then you may be in a situation where, again, when the next flush is getting ready to happen, again, maybe, you know, 5 to 6 days in advance of those starting to ripen and beginning to ripen, we may need a second application.
There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Joe and Ladysmith, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hey, thanks so much for taking this phone call. I've been researching jumping worms since this season, and I understand that there's no direct on-label treatments for jumping worms. As I research in China and New Zealand, they have all sorts of nasty ways of killing worms. And in the U.S., the only research I'm finding is treating through golf courses, like for treating worm castings. And I'm really kind of running to an end. I'm looking for a really nasty chemical to kill jumping worms. I have about 5 years of beautiful organic soil that was about 12 inches thick of loam that's been reduced to 3 inches of coffee grounds, and it's killing me.
Yeah. Oh boy. Well, PJ.
Yeah. And at this point, Joe, have you seen impacts on plants that are in that soil? Like, is this a flower bed? Are the plants kind of wilting and dying out, or are the plants themselves still doing okay?
So absolutely, the root structure, where like my pepper crops have gone through the basement, my tomatoes, I've got disease in my garden. In the past, I've just grown healthy soil, invited plants to stay for a season, and I've never had to use pesticides. I've never had problems with all the common flies and funguses that people talk about, because my plants just have amazing immune systems. They take care of it for me. And this year has just been an absolute disaster. I did read that 7 is quite toxic to earthworms, but when I talk to my old farmer buddies, they all say that 7 is not as potent as it used to be. And I don't know if that's a chemical change or if it's the application rates have changed.
Or they've become adapted.
Yeah, I mean, a couple thoughts here. The 7 that is available at the hardware store to you and I, the ingredient in it, even though the brand name is the same, over the last 5-10 years, the ingredient that is actually in it has changed. Also, again, jumping worms are not on the label for that. Another thought, though, is even if you had some sort of compound you could put on that would take them out of a garden bed setting, that would probably be temporary at best. And unfortunately, they're just going to recolonize the area over time. Compared to our normal earthworms, which have a generation per year, jumping worms, my analogy is you gave your run-of-the-mill earthworm a quadruple espresso. They do everything faster. They go through 2 generations per year. They can occur in higher densities than our European earthworms. And so they're just a real bear to deal with. And unfortunately, we don't have any great options. I know we have researchers at the UW Arboretum working on it. Historically, there had been a fertilizer-type product called Early Bird, which has been off the market for about 5 or so years. And this was a fertilizer, didn't have much actual NP and K to it, but it had some sort of tea tree meal that irritated the worms and worked well. And so there has been some research with that on golf courses, but again, you can't find it anymore. One suggestion with garden veggies, and I've seen this in my own yard because I've got jumping worms. When we put in like flowers in our yard, if we get the little transplants from the garden center, they don't do well. If we buy bigger ones to start off, or we grow our own and start them off bigger before we put them in the soil, then they seem to do much better with a more robust root system.
Hmm. Joe, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I'm sorry for your issue with the jumping worms. You're not alone. That's the only thing. Andrew in Madison called to ask if there is any ongoing experimentation in Wisconsin with genetically modified insects such as mosquitoes.
Not in Wisconsin, and certainly not with mosquitoes. I think that probably what Andrew is reminded of and remembering is that when several years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, when we started to see an emergence of Zika, and Zika is a... It's actually a virus disease transmitted by mosquitoes, and we were seeing it around, much of the Caribbean, and of course it was. It was having, pretty challenging and to some cases devastating effects for people, and people were asking about solutions and opportunities, and it was at that time that, a couple of different groups were working on what we called a gene drive system that involved a genetically modified insect. And they were trying to, what we would say, drive a deleterious gene through a population, that it would move fast and so on. So that was something that has been evaluated and continues to be evaluated as a means, of control. USEPA is here in the U.S. is very interested, to say the least, and provides considerable oversight in looking at these kinds of systems where an insect would be genetically modified to either drive a gene through a population or modified, say, for example, to resist being a transmitter. And so there are unquestionably a fair amount of good studies, fundamental studies, where people have documented and demonstrated that. But to the extent that they're being used right now, certainly not in the U.S. and not in Wisconsin.
Stuart in Token Creek emailed to say they have a lot of goldenrod soldier beetles on most of the flowers in their yard. What do they eat, and are their numbers increasing? Probably eat a lot of things.
Yeah, well, as adults, they're pollinators, and so it's actually really common to see them on a wide range of plants this time of the year. They're not harming the plants at all. Usually they're sitting there. They may be eating a bit of pollen, and they're mating. It's very easy to see that on flowers when they're doing that. The larvae at other times in the year are predatory. They're from the soldier beetle group, so they tend to feed on things like insect eggs, maybe some insect larvae that are around in the environment. So in my mind, they're beneficial all around. both as predators, as larvae. And then the adults are a really good example of a pollinator that's a beetle. And usually folks think a pollinator and maybe honeybee or bumblebee, but really any insect that's going to flowers and moving pollen can be a pollinator. These are a good example of that.
Larry in southern Wisconsin wants to know about the natural history of earwigs and whether they are prehistoric.
The group as a whole dates back to at least somewhere around maybe 300 or so million years. So it's an ancient lineage. And when you look at all of our insects, there's about almost 30 or so main groups of insects. They're relatively primitive, so to speak. So earwigs as a whole have been around a long time. Here in Wisconsin, we really only see the European earwig for the most part, which, as you can guess from the name, it's not native here. It's been in the state 30-plus years or thereabouts at this point. So they're pretty well established in terms of what they do. They're omnivorous, so they'll feed on plants. They can also scavenge on dead, dying, wounded insects, maybe a predator to a certain extent. But they're out there living in damp conditions, usually near the soil or mulch or plant beds, kind of doing their thing. They're also rather interesting from a natural history standpoint in that they provide some parental care. A lot of insects, the female lays eggs and says, see ya, I'm out of here. But with these, they actually provide some parental care. They hang out together with the young until they're old enough to wander out and go about things on their own, which is really pretty cool from that natural history standpoint.
That is very, very cool. Jennifer's got fruit flies in her kitchen drain.
Yeah, again, it goes back to moisture for these. They need moisture of some kind. They need organic matter. A kitchen drain fits that profile perfectly because you have all sorts of food gunk that gets down in there. I've even had cases where the point source has been in the dishwasher. There's that little strainer basket.
Yeah.
How often do you take that out to clean it?
Yeah.
Not that often, probably.
Not that often.
But it could be something overlooked like that. You have some food residue left behind. It remains moist. That's exactly what they need to rear some young.
Well, on that happy note, I think we're close to out of time here, and I want to thank you guys for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun, and we'll do it again. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
PJ Leash, degrees in biosciences and entomology, and is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And Professor Russ Groves, vegetable extension specialist and applied insect ecologist in the Department of Entomology, and a matter of fact, chairs the department, and supervises students and staff at the Vegetable Crop Entomology Laboratory. Great to have them with us. I want to mention once again that if you want to see a video of me tagging a butterfly, a monarch butterfly, a male as a matter of fact, I named him John. That is on Instagram and Facebook. I just did that yesterday, and I had a lot of fun doing it at the Beaver Creek Reserve. That link is on our page. So if you go to wpr.org/Larry, you'll find a link. But you can go to Instagram or Facebook and our Facebook page, and you'll find it there as well. Oh boy, that was fun actually, and I'm hoping John, my monarch, makes it to where he wanted to go. Coming up, we're going to take a look at rare plants in Wisconsin and some chance for you maybe to help out identifying and finding or maybe looking over and seeing how they're doing here in our state. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on the Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller here, and we are switching our attention to rare plants. In 2023, trained volunteers from all around Wisconsin submitted almost 200 reports of rare plants. More than 30 of those reports identified rare plants in areas where they were not previously known to exist. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is hoping to expand its core of volunteer citizen scientists searching for rare plants. And you know what? You don't need a whole lot of prior experience. Jessica Ross will tell us that's so. Jessica, with me in the studio, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR, coordinates the state agency's rare plant monitoring program. Jessica, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. You want to learn how to identify rare plants? Do you suspect there are some rare plants surviving in a natural area near you? Maybe you wonder about plans by the DNR. With the rare plant location information they receive. Give a call. Number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Jessica, this program, this Wisconsin Rare Plant Monitoring Program, was established, I think, in 2013,
That's right.
So give us the overall purpose and goals of the program.
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, we have almost 1,900 species of native plants. And of all those plants, 322 species are rare in Wisconsin. So they might be endangered, threatened, or listed as special concern. And so that's so many more plants that we can monitor and keep track mm-hmm. of. And so in 2013, Kevin Doyle, my colleague, started the Rare Plant Monitoring Program to get the botanical community involved and to get folks looking for these rare plants and submitting data to us so that we can understand how these plants are doing and in doing that, be able to protect them better in the state.
Yeah, and this is kind of a unique program, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's pretty unique. I may be a little biased, but plants are pretty great.
Oh, well, last year there was a volunteer help find Marilyn Senna.
Yes, that was a really exciting story. So that plant hadn't been seen in Wisconsin in 100 years. And so this volunteer took it upon himself. He was just really excited about this particular plant and searched far and wide. It took him several years, but eventually he finally found this Marilyn Senna. And we have stories like these every year where these dedicated volunteers go out and find these plants that haven't been seen in so long but are such an important and beautiful part of Wisconsin's yeah. flora. So it's really exciting to have volunteers go out and do this.
When it's that rare, I'm sure there's not very many people listening who know what the heck it even looks like. Can you tell us a little about the Marilyn Senna?
Yeah, so Marilyn Senna is a member of the bean family, Fabaceae. And so it has these bright yellow flowers. It has leaves that, if you think about what peas and beans kind of look like, leaves like that. It has beans in the fall for its fruits. And sennas are actually commonly in plantings as well. So you might see different species of senna, Senna hibacarpa, in some prairie plantings as well around town. So it might be more familiar than you think.
So what are some other ones that have been rare species that have been discovered as part of this program?
Oh my gosh, we have so many cool rare species.
Great.
Wisconsin has several species of orchids, which are beautiful and incredible to see out in the wild. Here in Madison, where we are, right around here, we have white lady slippers and yellow lady slippers that are really beautiful to see. We have rare plants that are really teeny tiny, like the tiniest little fern called a little goblin moonwort, which you kind of have to pull the leaves aside to see. We have big rare species like trees. Chinkapin oak and sycamores are rare in Wisconsin. So we have plants, all different kinds of plants. We have thistles. We have aquatic plants. There's a rare cranberry. So there are all sorts of rare plants. The opportunities to find them are endless.
Well, I was thinking about the Calypso orchid.
Yeah.
That is a rare plant, but man, would I love to see one in the wild.
Well, we'll have to get you signed up with the program. You can become a rare plant monitor.
That is the most beautiful orchid.
It is. We have some really incredible orchids in the southern part of the state. So that's kind of more of a northern species. Yeah. In the southern part of the state, we also have eastern prairie fringed orchid, which is an incredibly beautiful white orchid. I know you just had some insect folks on. So that one's pollinated by a hawk moth, which is pretty cool, too. So we have lots and lots of cool plants.
So why do we need to keep track of these?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are lots of reasons, aside from just taking care of the place we live. They have intrinsic value just existing as organisms. But plants and rare plants have lots of other reasons that we should take care of them, too. So some of them are utilitarian. Some rare plants are things like relatives of cranberries, or ginseng used to be considered a rare plant. So these are plants that people use and eat and use medicinally and things like that. Other reasons we might care about rare plants are, we've already talked about how beautiful some of them are, like the calypso orchid or eastern prairie fringed orchid. Some of these are just the most beautiful things, and it is really important to preserve that beauty. But then there's also the ecological importance of some of these plants. So we have a rare plant called pitcher's thistle, which is one of a rare plant. It's one of the most important floral resources for pollinators on the sand dunes along Lake Michigan, where it grows. Mm. So some of these rare plants have really important roles ecologically. So we want to protect every part of the ecosystem so that we can make sure that it functions in the way that we need it to, and the way that the other organisms need it to as well.
And I looked at a map, a Wisconsin map, showing spots where we know these rare plants exist. So for somebody volunteering, would they be looking for new ones, or would they be maybe doing, you know, observing and seeing how things are going over time with plants?
Sure, that's a great question. This program is kind of like a choose your own adventure for rare plant monitors. So we have rare plant populations in every county in the state. So it doesn't matter where you are in the state, you can participate in this program. But we can send out, usually we send folks to our website, and they can go to something called the Rare Plant Finder, which is a big map. They can search by season, they can search by location, and choose a rare plant that they're interested in surveying. So once they've decided what they want to survey, we'll send them maps and all the information that we have about the particular population so that they can go out and find it and report back on how this population is doing. But as people are doing that, sometimes they find populations that we didn't expect. I was out on a rare plant survey earlier this year, and I found a brand new population of white adder's mouth, which is a tiny, tiny little orchid. So you never know when you're in these habitats. You want to look for the survey that we sent you, but
yeah,
you might find something new, too. So you never know what you might find.
Never know what you're going to find when you get out there. Jessica Ross, our guest today, botanist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. And Jessica coordinates the Wisconsin Rare Plant Monitoring Program. Maybe you've been involved in the program. Maybe you have questions about it, or maybe you have just questions about rare plants. I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today, and I hope you'll join in tomorrow at this time. We'll have a book club discussion. It's our Larry Mueller Show book club time. Jeffrey Bolt. We'll be talking about his thriller. It's set in Wisconsin. It's really cool. It's a very good book. It's titled Blue Lake. It's a mystery novel set in Wisconsin, a couple different places in Wisconsin, actually. And I'm really looking forward to talking with him. I finished the book last week, I think, and it was great. Well, and then we will talk about professionalism in the workplace. And it kind of, there's some of that professionalism kind of rearing its head in good and bad ways in the book, Blue Lake. So it'll be fun talking about professionalism in the workplace with two Marquette University business instructors. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Right now we're visiting with Jessica Ross, and we're talking about this program that the DNR runs. It's a volunteer program for the DNR Rare Plant Monitoring Project. So we're talking about the rare plants that exist in the state and how you might get involved in a monitoring program. And you don't need a lot of previous experience, if I'm not mistaken, Jessica.
You don't. It helps to know a little bit about what plants are around, but there are so many good apps and resources that you can kind of find out what plants are in around the rare plants as well. So you really don't need a ton of experience. You need to be trained in the program, and you can find a training online. If you Google rare plant monitoring program, it'll come up right away. And so we have an online training that folks can take at any time they want. They can take it at their own speed. After you do that, you just have to take an online quiz and then send us an email, and you're all set to start monitoring rare plants. And there are rare plants that you can find all year, year round. So any time is a great time to become a rare plant monitor.
Yeah, and I went. I took a look at the website and the information about the program and the plants, and I thought it was well done, and it gives you a heck of a lot. I didn't go through the whole thing, but I went through quite a bit of it just out of curiosity, and then it was kind of interesting to see what was going on in it. Might even be worth, in fact, it would be worth looking at, even if you're not interested in joining the program. It might, tell you what, it might entice you to take a look at it.
I think so. We have some really incredible rare plants in Wisconsin. So I would encourage you to go to our website and check it out if you think you might be interested.
Judy in Sturgeon Bay, is over by Whitefish Dunes, a matter of fact, I believe, is with us. Let's go there. Judy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question for you. My mother was so proud of these little thistles that she had at her Lake Michigan cottage that would live in the ground for like 30 years and then pop their little heads out. And she passed away recently, and I want to kind of be on the lookout for them so I can protect them as well, but I don't know what I'm looking for.
Yeah, it sounds like those very well could be dune thistle, which I was talking about earlier as such an important resource for pollinators on dunes. But they pretty much look, if you think about a garden thistle that you is kind of the bane of your existence in your garden, it's kind of like that, but a bit smaller, kind of white and fuzzy, kind of that basil rosette, that the leaves that come right out of the ground. Look for that type of thing. And then there are lots of good resources to look at pictures of these types of things, to look at dune thistle online. But there are also good apps like iNaturalist and Seek, or another good one that I like is called PlantNet. And then you can just take a picture of the plant that you might think is a thistle, or any plant in general, and it will give you a good idea of what it might be. And so that's a good way to sort of get started with plant ID, too.
I'm trying to remember if there's a dune thistle in that training program, photo of one.
I think it comes up. It's a really nice plant. It's a really nice one in that area, too.
Well, Judy, I tell you what, you could become a monitor for dune thistles.
It's true.
In Sturgeon Bay, and as long as it sounds like you're interested in these, and partly because of your mom, but for maybe a lot of reasons, you might want to take a look at joining in that program. What do you think?
Oh, definitely.
Judy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number the call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. John wonders, are there particular plant species that you task volunteers for?
We generally let volunteers pick which plants they're interested in because we have such a wide variety. We let volunteers say, I'm interested in these orchids, or I'm really good at sedge identification. Give me a a sedge survey or something like that. So we have, out of these 322 rare species in Wisconsin, we have lots of choice. So we let volunteers choose, but if they need a little bit of help, we can help them narrow down a survey too.
Yeah, and I suppose for, among the volunteers you have, well, how many do you have? About 500 or so?
We do. In a given, it varies in a given year, but we've trained over 1,000 volunteers.
And I would imagine that typically, unlike the guy that we were talking about earlier who found the Senna, they probably maybe work in their own or like to do the work sort of in their own area.
Yeah, we have volunteers who do all sorts of different things in the rare plant monitoring program. So we have some folks who go on vacation. If they're from southern Wisconsin and they go up north, they say, I'm going on vacation, give me these surveys, which is great because then they get to see new habitats, they get to see new plants that they wouldn't normally get to see. And so we have some people who kind of stick close to home. Usually there are plants to find close to home, but there are some people who like to travel around the state to see new things. I think it gets kind of addicting once you start finding these rare plants. It's really exciting and it is incredibly helpful. So it kind of inspires you to keep going and keep looking for more.
Jeannie in Door County, we'll go to you. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. I found a nodding trillium on my property, and I was wondering if that was a rare plant in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's a great question. What a beautiful plant to see, too. Nodding trillium isn't considered rare in Wisconsin, but we do have a rare trillium in Wisconsin called snow trillium, Trillium nivale. And so nodding trillium might be a good indicator of some really nice habitat. You could try looking around and see if you have some other trilliums there. That one's not rare, but still beautiful to see.
Yeah, what are they? Some people are going to say, well, what do they look like?
Oh, so trilliums, these particular ones have big white flowers. They're a spring ephemeral. So popping up in the spring, the first flowers, they're pretty close to the ground, maybe less than a foot tall, and they have three leaves. So trillium means three. So three leaves and three big petals, and they're just these beautiful big white flowers. Nodding trillium is called nodding because its flower kind of dips down, nodding a little bit. And snow trillium is called snow trillium because it pops up really early when there might still be snow on the ground in some places.
Oh, so the time for Jeannie to be looking for them would be early in the
early
spring?
Early in the springtime.
Because they sort of seem to disappear? Or...
Right, just, yeah, that's a great, I didn't explain what ephemerals meant, but spring ephemerals are plants that pop up in the spring and by the summer or late spring even kind of disappear. Mm-hmm. So there are certain plants that you need to survey at a particular time, otherwise you won't be able to see them. But trilliums would be one where springtime is the perfect time to look for them.
Basically, you know, for why does a plant become rare? I mean, what are the things that cause that to happen?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So there are a lot of reasons that a plant can be rare. It can be that they've always been rare in Wisconsin. So we have a rare plant called Northern Monk's Hood that only grows kind of on moist, steeping cliffs. And we don't have a lot of that habitat in Wisconsin. We have some in the Driftless. But these plants have always been rare. They'll continue to be rare because we won't get more of that habitat. So there are plants like that. There are plants that are rare because of loss of habitat. So here in southern Wisconsin, we used to have a lot more prairie habitat. And since we don't have as much prairie, we have barely any prairie compared to what we used to. Some of these prairie plants are really rare. So loss of habitat. And then there can be things like more recent threats, like invasive species, pests, disease, deer, things like that, that threaten plants too. And then climate change, we don't really know what will happen with all of these rare plants, but we can expect that climate change will also threaten some rare plants as
well. I would. And then how do you use that information? I mean, how is it used?
Yeah, so all of the volunteers go on these surveys and collect data for us. And at the end of the year, we sort of compile this and think about how all these rare plants are doing. And so the first really important step in conserving these rare plants is knowing how they're doing. And we can't know without the help of our volunteers. So our volunteers are really kind of taking a temperature check, checking up on these plants, seeing how they're doing, if they're not doing well, telling us what's causing declines, what's threatening these plants. And then we can use that information to help these plants so we can actively pursue management if there's something like an invasive species or brush or something like that impacting a plant. If we use all of this information to assess how we can better help these plants and how we can make sure that they don't disappear.
Yeah. And as I think you said earlier, some of them have medicinal values. And I know there was at least one or two plants that were may have been harvested out of into rarity.
Sure. We have poaching is a threat to plants, to rare plants in Wisconsin. I think for some of these orchids, they're really beautiful. People might try to pick them sometime if they ever see them, which I would not recommend you do. Or things like golden seal that have medicinal value. People get excited to see these plants and want to harvest them and use them. But I would encourage you to please be respectful to these plants and their ecosystems and to admire them from afar, or even better, become a rare plant monitor so you can check up on them and tell us how they're doing and help conserve them for the future.
Yeah, and you know, I'll go back to the Calypso orchid that I just think is so beautiful. If you took it out of its where it lives and try to put it in your house or something, it just is not going to work.
It's true. It wouldn't work very well. Our orchids are really evolved to be in the habitat that they're in, and they're co-evolved with fungi that are associated with their roots. And so it's really hard. This is another challenge for conservation. It's hard to cultivate these orchids because you need to make sure that you can cultivate the fungi that are associated with their roots too. So it's really difficult to grow them outside of where they are supposed to live.
So take some good photos.
Take some good photos. We love good photos.
And is that, do you get a bunch of photos from the volunteers, or how do they report?
Oh, yeah. So volunteers submit reports either on iNaturalist, or we have a form that they can submit online. And it's required that they submit a photo, too, which is really great. Yeah. Great to help us ID them, but wonderful at the end of the year when we're looking through all these reports, we can see all of the exciting plants that people have found.
Yeah.
And then in the springtime, we compile an annual report, which you can find on our website for previous years. And we put together all the stories and all the information that rare plant monitors have found over the year. And we include lots of their photos because they take such good photos. A lot of times we get selfies too. People are so happy to have found the rare plant they were looking for. And so those are really wonderful to see too, because it's about the plants, but it's also about the relationship with people too.
You could put together a pretty cool poster.
Oh, definitely.
Of all of the, or of many of the rare plants that have, photos of those that have been put together by your volunteers.
Oh, yeah. Some of our volunteers, I think, could have a gig on the side as photographers, too, because they take some beautiful photos.
So, again, how do we get involved in this?
Yeah, so this training for the Rare Plant Monitoring Program is available year-round online, and you just have to Google Wisconsin Rare Plant Monitoring Program. And I would love to get your emails. I would love to have folks, if you have questions about it, feel free to send a message my way. But take the training, check out our website, learn a bit more about the rare plants in Wisconsin, because there's always more to learn. So I would encourage you to just get out there and be curious first, and then come monitor with us.
Well, I tell you what, I did take a look at that training program. It was really an interesting program. I mean, just interesting in and of itself, and may kind of entice more than one person to want to volunteer and sign up.
Yeah, it's pretty cool because volunteers do the exact same thing that professional botanists would be doing on their surveys. So the protocol's not changed because you're a volunteer. You're doing exactly what professional botanists would be doing. So it's a really exciting program to be a part of.
Jessica, great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a lot of fun. Jessica Ross, botanist with the Wisconsin DNR Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation, and she is coordinator of the Wisconsin Rare Plant Monitoring Program. So that was really interesting, and I tell you what, take a look at that website and see about maybe getting some training and signing up. Want to thank her, and I want to thank you for listening in, and thanks to our team. You know, it's a whole team. It's a show that is a team effort, and we've got producers Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors Jeff Robbins and Lee Raybert, and our executive director is Jill Nanoa, and then I am tagging along. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News. Thank you.